All right. So we're on page 176, and I have a couple of comments on 176. The first thing is I noticed that I made a mark over a mark on the margin on this passage from Hosea 4, 1 to 2, which I thought was really interesting. There is no faithfulness or kindness, no knowledge of God in the land. There is swearing, lying, killing, stealing, committing adultery. They break all the bounds, and murder follows murder. And I thought, I tell you, the more that I read about the prophets, the more I am convinced that Western civilization is in really serious trouble. I thought it was before. Roseanne says I'm way too much of a pessimist, but that's probably because I read history. And the historical consciousness, even back to the prophets, is pretty clear that once you exile God from the society, then all of the rest of this follows, and we're just watching it unravel as we live in a world where, since the Enlightenment, God has been pushed out of the equation. But now, a really interesting comment, given that, what he says in the next paragraph, it's the bottom 176. Like other prophets, Hosea knew that Israel's destiny depended on its sense of mission. And I found that really interesting, because the sense of mission that is given to Israel at Sinai, which is to become a holy nation and a royal priesthood, has never been fulfilled. Right? I mean, think about it. If your mission is to be a holy nation, okay, maybe you can do that. Internally, you just focus on the same thing that the prophets are crying out for, which is social justice and a sense of godliness, et cetera, et cetera. But the second part of that mission is a royal priesthood. And the royal priesthood piece of the mission to Israel has never been one of their objectives, right? And I found that really interesting that Sachs is noting that the prophets are calling them to their destiny, the chosen people to their destiny, but I can't think of any time in the history of Israel when they have reached out to the community in an effort to bring awareness of the God of Israel to the larger society, which is a fascinating idea, right? Here it is, as he says, the destiny of Israel depends on them fulfilling this mission. And yet here we are, basically 3,000 years into this thing, and we're still waiting for that piece of the mission to be fulfilled.
Okay? I'm just curious.
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay, wait a minute.
Go ahead, Maddie.
Phyllis and Maddie. Phyllis, go ahead.
I was just curious. You say the mission, which I understand, but isn't it supposed to be more of a light unto the nation, an example to follow, not something that you necessarily bring, you know, physically bring people?
Yes. Yes. So I'm not talking about proselytizing or recruiting or evangelism, as we would say in the Protestant faith, but I am. And you're right. You're supposed to be a light to the nations. But what I'm thinking about is this. If I'm going to be a light to the nations, I at least have to have a relationship with the outside world, right? I can't be a light to the nations if I isolate myself in such a way so that I close the doors to allowing the outside world to see what I'm doing so that they're attracted to it. Even a magnetic attraction has to have a metal to attract to it, right?
Sure.
So I'm thinking, and I understand perfectly well how this happens, right? In fact, one of the things that I've lectured on the ships is the odd situation where in the 10th century, 10, 11, and 1200s, the Jews fled Europe to North Africa to be protected by the Muslims, right? This is crazy. The Muslims were offering protection to the Jews from the Christians. All of that turned around, and some amazing things happened in history that actually reversed all of that. But the point is that at one point, their relationship with the outsiders was with Islam. It was never with the West. So I can understand why they would feel threatened by the West because of a long series of persecutions from the 3rd century on, thanks mostly to the Christian church and its theology. But the point is, as they close the community, to protect themselves. They, in ipso facto, did not fulfill the mission. You can't be a royal priesthood if you're only interacting with your side of the equation. A priest has to stand in the middle between the two, right? And I just found this really interesting that Sachs would note that the prophets are saying that the objective is to act as a royal priesthood, which means that I have to have an attraction, as you said, so other people will see what God is doing. But in order for that to happen, I have to be open to the community to allow that relationship to grow so that I can invite them in as Abraham did. Right?
You also can't be a light, I guess, if most people hate you.
Well, I would say you can't be a light if, as Yeshua says, you can't be a light if you put a basket over the candle, right? I mean, if you close the doors so that no one can see what's happening in your community because you're afraid, I understand that you'd be afraid. I mean, there's plenty of history for that. But as you close the door and shut the window so that no one can see what's actually happening inside the synagogue, you ipso facto fail to fulfill the mission. It's a really, really odd situation because what it really says is that God knows that there's going to be resistance, right? But that he's asking them to take this enormous risk nevertheless, right?
I wonder if that's part of the problem. You become kind of mysterious. People don't trust you, you know?
I think part of the problem is, if I were going to say, who's to blame for that? I would say that the Christian church is to blame for that. The Christian church from the second century on acted in such a way that the Jews were as Luther even calls them children of the devil. I mean, in fact, Phyllis, it's exactly what you see happening today.
Yeah.
Right?
Politically,
you see the same thing happening today, right? Yeah. So the outsider, the one who doesn't agree with me, is no longer a human. They're, what are they? Reprobates, it's on and on. You call them everything, Nazis, fascists, whatever you want to call them, to make sure that they are never welcomed into your community so that there's no relationship there. You cut off the relationship. Okay, I got that. So I can understand perfectly well, given the history of what Christianity did to Judaism, despite the Pope's efforts today, 2,000 years too late, right? I can understand perfectly well what happened. What's interesting is that Sachs recognizes that as well and basically says that the prophets, which is, pre-Yeshua, were calling for this same risk, to be able to open yourself up for this risk. And without fail, it didn't happen, right? Mm-hmm. The humanity of self-protection got in the way of divine risk. Right?
Yeah.
Which is really interesting. Now, think about this. It's really interesting because if we get to the Genesis book that Sachs wrote, we'll find this. But one of the things that we recognize is that God is the risk taker, because what he says is, I'm going to attach my name to these people, and insofar as they act on my behalf, my name will be honored. But if they don't act on my behalf, my name will be dishonored and the world will not recognize me, right? So God is the supreme risk taker and he asks his people to take the same risk. And of course, from the human side, that's a risk in light of the potential threat and certain rejection. But nevertheless, it's exactly how God behaves. He's a risk taker. With every one of us, he's a risk taker because we can all fail him.
There's one Jewish community that is pretty much a risk taker and attempts to do exactly what is supposed to be done. That's a Chabad. Not everyone. We're not talking about every single individual, but they're sent out with a one-way ticket around the world to the most remote areas. And they open their doors. I mean, today everybody's wary, but they open their doors. You're not, generally speaking, turned away if you are, as long as you aren't belligerent and if you walk into their building and you walk into their services, you're welcome. Mostly.
Yeah. Thanks for reminding me of that, because you're absolutely right. I have, a sort of tangent relationship with a couple of the rabbis in Chabad because of my support of them. And you're right, absolutely, they were extremely welcoming and very, very hospitable. Yeah, you're absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. So there is an exception to the rule. Right. That's really important to know.
Well, that's what the Rebbe, this is, the Rebbe sent out Jonathan Sachs as well. He spoke to him and told him, go. Right, this is what you should be doing. I mean, you've got to see a little blurb about it and talk to people that knew it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Clear, and it goes away, as Sachs points out. This didn't, it wasn't invented, post the turn of the millennia. It was found in the prophets, and it was found way before that in the life of Abraham. So we're right back to the beginning. Okay. So if nobody else has a comment on that, we'll continue because I want to get over to the next page, 177.
Skip, I just wanted to say, I'll send you some clips. There is a phenomenal push coming out of Israel, which is not necessarily just Chabad. But Chabad, I understand, I agree with Lindy. But I'll send you some clips. It's very exciting.
Okay.
Maggie, would you say that's the Mizorti community?
The Arrogant Farm, the Land of Israel.
Oh, that's Ari and Jeremy. Yeah.
That's correct. Jeremy. I'll send it to you.
Yeah. And Lindy's right in pointing out the people behind that because they're the ones that we normally would interact with when I was doing tours in Israel. And you're right. They're very, very welcoming. It's the same thing with Moshe Kapinski. You know, he's incredibly welcoming. Yeah, so there are significant exceptions. It's just interesting that he would make this comment. And by the way, he doesn't say, when a few people in Israel, he's talking about Israel as a whole, right? Jose knew that Israel's destiny, the entire community of Israel, right? So,
and what has happened, just real quick, is that a lot of the hostages, thank you God, the ones that came back, have turned back to religion, to their belief system. Never mind religion, get rid of the word religion, but turned back to belief in God as opposed to the ones that were in the kibbutz where that was attacked. They were anything but religious, anything but observant. So,
Okay, so let's look at 177. And here I'm just making this notation on the side from the passage in Hosea. Look what he says here in the second half of this passage. I will betroth you in righteousness and justice, in love and compassion. I will betroth you in faithfulness, and you will know the Lord. So that's the thing that's interesting about that is Hosea is calling, or God is calling through Hosea for renewed vows, right? That's what I have in my margin, renewed vows. And think about what's really missing in our society today. And you could just outline those: righteousness, justice, love, compassion, faithfulness. That's it. Any one of those would begin to change the circumstances that we live in. So let's go over to the next page, 178. In the paragraph that starts, here the male-female relationship is predicated on something quite other. In the last sentence, the only relationship able to bind them together without the use of force is marriage as a covenant, a bond of mutual loyalty and love in which each makes a pledge to the other to serve one another. So this is interesting because remember he's been talking about abad, which is the word for work, which also means to serve. And what's interesting about this is that he notes that the only relationship that actually successfully maintains the building blocks of a working society is marriage. And in this case, a covenant marriage with God. But it's exactly the same thing in the society we live in. If you don't have a strong commitment to marriage in a society, you will fracture the society along lines of relationship, right? And I think we've seen that happen over the last 50 years, for sure. Okay, so he goes on.
Yes. That whole paragraph I wrote down in my notes because I thought if there was any kind of marriage preparation for a couple, that whole paragraph is enough to you know, decide if this is really what you want to get into.
Put a foundation down.
And we thought, so I wrote it down. I'm thinking my grandchildren are ages to, you know, get married. I'm thinking one of these days I'm going to be able to give them that so that they can discuss it.
Yeah.
And see what it all means. Because that's really the essence, you know, of society, but also of a marriage relationship, right?
Yeah. And notice something else really important about his sentence here. Look what he says, right? Let's read it one more time. The only relationship able to bind them together without the use of force. Okay? Now, that's really interesting because if you think about the ancient society of Israel, it didn't have policemen. It didn't have jails. It didn't have prosecutors and criminal defense attorneys. Why? Because it was built on the idea of a covenant marriage. And you see, in a covenant marriage, you don't need force to enlist loyalty, right? Once you remove that foundation, now you have to have force. Now you need a police force. You need a judicial system. You need courts. You need jails. You need all that kind of stuff, right? And I've often pondered the fact that Israel, when you think about it, think about all the disobedience that happened in Israel. But there's no jail time. There's no prisons. There's no, you know, policemen arresting people. Why? Because the foundation of the society is, in spite of the disobedience, it's still built on this idea that the covenant relationship provides loyalty, a binding together, mutual service, etc. So once I start to disturb that covenant relationship, everything else follows. Now the government has to enlist force in order to get compliance. Okay, let's go to the next paragraph. It says the next paragraph, the last bit of the sentence. He says, God reaches out to humanity not as power, the storm, the thunder, the rain, but as love, not an abstract philosophical love, but a deep and abiding passion which survives all the disappointments and betrayals. And there it is right there, right? Because we would say, okay, wait a minute, Israel was in a covenant relationship, but look how many times they messed up. And now he answers that in this sentence. What's the implication? That the covenant relationship survives in spite of disappointments and betrayals, which is why God can say in Hosea, you're not my people, and turn right around and say, but I embrace you and I accept you as my people. In other words, God's covenant relationship isn't broken by the disobedience or disappointment of Israel. And think about that in terms of the foundation of a society. Think about how many times in society today, a disappointment or a betrayal ends in the separation of the relationship, the destruction of the relationship. Why doesn't that happen in Israel? Because God's covenant relationship is stronger than that. Okay, and he says in this last paragraph on this page, in the beginning of the next page, just I can outline the whole thing. How we relate to God affects how we relate to other people. Just stop right there, the one in italics. If you measured the society today in its relationship to God, you would have a perfect measurement of why the society is falling apart. Because the relationship to God is next to nothing, zero. It's in name only, right? Even if it exists, it exists only in name. Okay, so now what he says. How we relate to God affects how we relate to other people, right? That is Hosea's message, and vice versa. How we relate to other people affects the way we think of God. Israel's political chaos in the 8th century BCE was intimately connected to its religious waywardness. And here's the sentence. A society built on corruption and exploitation is one where might prevails over right. That is not Judaism, but idolatry, Baal worship. Okay? Think about that. Where might prevails over right. So, take your assessment of today's contemporary Western civilization, not just in America, but across the entire West, and ask yourself whether or not the society prevails on the basis of might or right. Because what he's saying is if it prevails on the basis of might, it is idolatrous, right? Because it's already dealt God out of the picture. So even if the society claims to be a quote-unquote religious society, if it acts on the basis of power instead of on the basis of justice, it is an idolatrous culture. And then he goes on. Now we understand why the sign of the covenant is circumcision. For faith to be more than the worship of power, It must affect the most intimate relationship between men and women. And then I have at the bottom of that paragraph, the sexual drive must be circumcised and circumcised so that it no longer seeks to possess and instead and is instead content to love. And he has referred many times to this book. I'm not going to be able to find it. Who is the author? I can't remember now. It's the book about civilization and marriage. But now I don't remember the author, so I can't find it on my bookshelf. Okay, but it's there someplace. Anyway, the point is, what he said is that this particular author, and I can't remember, he mentioned him by name, and if I could remember the name, I'd find the book. But the whole point is that this guy argues that the invention of monogamy is what saved the society from utter collapse into basically the exercise of power. And it's really interesting that Sachs picks that up, because what he's saying is that the invention of monogamy, which happens within the Jewish culture, even though not always adhered to, right? It's part of the Genesis 2 passage, but not always adhered to. The point is that that foundation separates a covenant relationship from a power relationship. And if you look at the old, if you look at the history of other empires, you will always see that the powerful violate the requirement of monogamy that God puts in place. And the result of that is a collapse of the society, right?
It turns
into a society of aggression. Yeah, Dennis.
No, well, it was Larry. It was Larry.
Oh, Larry.
Larry.
Oh, what?
Skip, would that be James Black, when Nations Die?
No, it's called Marriage and Civilization.
Okay.
And he's mentioned it a couple of times. I just can't remember it. I know I have it here on my bookshelf someplace, but trying to find it in a hurry is not going to happen.
Hey, Skip?
Yes.
I did want to add in, you notice we didn't see jails and prisons until the New Testament when Rome took over.
Yes. Okay, here's the book, Marriage and Civilization. Okay? It's by William Tucker, and it says, How Monogamy Made Us Human, right? Which is really interesting, because his argument is that monogamy is the thing that created a society where people can work together because they're no longer in competition, right? You need the rule of monogamy, which says one man for one woman and vice versa, in order to restrict the power of the elite to accumulate multiple females and consequently create competition to get things done instead of cooperation. It's a really interesting book. Not religious, but a really important, interesting idea on how civilizations actually survived. Okay, let's go to the next part of this one, page 179. It's about the third paragraph down. The Hebrew word emunah, often translated as faith, it's a lot more than that, in fact means faithfulness, fidelity, precisely the commitment one undertakes in making a marriage. Conversely, for the prophets, there is a connection between idolatry and adultery. Okay? And he said that already, and that's what he's really pushing here, is that once you break down the relationship of monogamy in a society, you're already in a idolatrous society. Okay, so now he says at the bottom of the page, he's talking about Song of Songs. He means the knowledge and intimacy of relationship, the touch of two selves across the metaphysical abyss that separates one consciousness from another. That is the theme of Song of Songs, that deeply human yet deeply mystical expression of Eros. And I would stop right there. I have a little question mark in my margin, because I don't think Song of Songs is about Eros at all. Eros is the Greek, you know, there are four Greek terms for love. And you're familiar with agape and eros, yes, and philia, right? Philia, brotherly love, sorge, which is a family love. You know, I love my children. Agape, which is basically selfless love, according to the New Testament usage of it. It's an old, real ancient Hebrew word or Greek word that actually fell out of use until the apostles resurrected it. But eros is the love of possession, right? That's why you can say, I love baseball. And what you mean is, I want to be part of me. Okay. So I think he's used the wrong term here. Yes, Song of Songs is definitely about intimacy, but it's not an intimacy of possession. It's an intimacy of what I would say selfless care for the other. And that, of course, isn't the concept of the Greek eros, which is, by the way, interesting because eros never appears in the apostolic writings at all, because I think that they were quite aware that it's the wrong Greek word. Okay? So let's jump over to the last of this section, page 180. And at the very end, he's talking about the Brit Mila. Okay, so he says, helps transform the male from a Baal, that's a lord, to an Ish, a man, from dominant partner to loving husband. Just as God tells Hosea that this is what he seeks in relationship with people of the covenant. Circumcision turns biology into spirituality. The instinctive male urge to reproduce becomes instead a covenantal act of partnership and mutual affirmation. It was thus as decisive a turn in human civilization as Abrahamic monotheism itself. Both are about abandoning power as the basis of relationship and instead aligning ourselves with what Dante called the love that moves the sun and the stars. Okay? So this is interesting, right? Because the command for circumcision is to the parents. The child has nothing to say about it. Okay? Think about this. What he's saying is that circumcision is this shift from power to participation, from domination to love, right? And what we're really saying in the Hebrew community is it's involuntary. I don't decide if I'm going to be circumcised. My parents decided that, which means that the responsibility for understanding the significance of the sign falls on the parent because the child is 8 days old, right? That's really interesting, isn't it? Because it isn't a sign that I take on myself. It's a sign given to me that requires that I have the education necessary to understand it later. And more importantly, notice that it's only for males, right? Why is that? Why would God expect circumcision as a sign of the covenant to be only for males? Because males are in ancient society, males are the dominant power seekers, right? So what he's done is he's taken that aggressive nature of all the societies that surrounded Israel, the idea of dominance over others, and converted it for the gender most likely to exercise it. Okay, Linda, you had something to add?
Well, I was just going to add about circumcision. Should any of you have ever gone to a Brit Milah, a ceremony where a child has been circumcised? It's not just the parents and the moil, or some people use a doctor, depending, but it's a whole ceremony. It's a whole commitment. It's really beautiful. Kid doesn't really know what's going on, but
yes.
But it's an entire ceremony where a community is involved. So it's not just this couple or these parents doing this. It's just something that is passed on and passed on and passed on, and it is a community event.
Yeah.
If you've gone to one that people are religious, you know that there's no invitation. It's announcement. It's an announcement there is a circumcision. And then as many people that want to come or are able to come can come. That's an ultra-religious, you know, today in this world. But it's a really a beautiful thing. And it does show the commitment of the community.
Yeah, and that's it underlines the point that I'm making, that it isn't the child who's responsible for understanding what's happening, because that's not possible at 8 days. It's a commitment by the parents, and you're right, by the community, that they will educate the child into what this means.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that has to happen from the community side, because a child can't figure it out on his own, no matter if he grows up or not. It has to be communicated. The essence of the covenant, which it symbolizes, is ambiguous unless explained.
And by the way, ladies, there is a community event for the girls 30 days later. And it's done usually in a synagogue, and it's called the baby naming, where, it, again, it's a community event. So everything is community, 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 or people, people, people. Yeah.
No, I understand that. But the interesting part about about circumcision itself as a from a gender perspective is that it does exactly the opposite of what the ancient societies were all about. So I'll give you an example. If you've been to Pompeii, one of the things that you discover in Pompeii is a house of basically a brothel, and in that brothel are frescoes, and the frescoes show the dominance of the male. And it has absolutely nothing to do with gender. That's why homosexuality in Rome was perfectly acceptable, because it had nothing to do with sex. It had everything to do with power, right? So the whole idea behind Roman sexuality was dominance, right? And that, of course, is exactly the opposite of what's happening here, right? It's the whole point of circumcision is to remove the aggressive dominance that marked all these ancient civilizations.
Two things. I was just wondering, was it just the Jews that got circumcised? Weren't there other nations around that circumcised their
children? Yeah, the Egyptians practiced it as well.
Well, but Israel was circumcised at 13. Abraham had his son circumcised at 13. You will find often in the Arab communities, there's a circumcision at 13. It is not the same. I mean, it's the same. It's a covenant, but not the covenant that was given to Abraham to give to us.
Right, but the point of circumcision in the Hebrew community is that it's a symbol of your relationship with the covenant-keeping God. And it's not just a passage rite into adulthood. Right, as it would be in ancient societies that practice circumcision, it wasn't a mark of spiritual connection. It was a rite of passage into adulthood.
So I only thought that was a covenant mark, but I have a hard time putting my head around this whole notion of power, and that was a sign that, I mean, it doesn't take away power. In a sense, it's just a philosophical thing, isn't it? I mean, physically, circumcision doesn't take away the power of man.
No, you're absolutely right, and that's the whole point. The point is, it has an physical attribute itself is completely ambiguous. In other words, it has no effect at all on whether or not the person demonstrates sexual priority or power. Right? But it is a mark that demands interpretation. And in ancient societies, it was a mark of a rite of passage into maturity, right? As exemplified in the passage of, as circumcision at age 13, a rite of passage into the adulthood of the community. But at 8 days, it basically is completely unknown. I mean, a 13-year-old who goes through it understands in the community, this is my rite of passage into adulthood. But at day eight, nobody understands that. So it demands interpretation in order to understand what's happening. And it certainly isn't anything about a rite of passage from puberty, that's for sure. Pam, you had something you want to add? No?
But Iskara wrote a note.
Okay. All right. So let's continue on page 183. Now he's going to talk about childbirth. And he says, the top of the page, it's important to note that these words do not have the same kind of resonance as they bear in English. Tameh does not mean impure or defiled. It is a technical term meaning that one is in a condition that prevents him from entering the tabernacle. Tahor means the opposite, that he may enter. Okay? Why is this important? Because we often stumble over the fact that there is a purity requirement, a lengthy purity requirement on women after childbirth. And everybody says in the non-observant community. Oh, why would there be this kind of, you know, ridiculous rule? Okay. And, but the point that Sachs is making is it has nothing to do with the physical circumstances. It has everything to do with a religious concept, a ritual that of passage, a symbol of purity that's required. And the determination of how long it goes is completely up to God. It has absolutely nothing to do with the physical or the physical aftermath of childbirth. Okay. And then he says at the bottom of the same page, for what therefore bars us from entering the holy is anything that reminds us or others of our mortality. The fact that we are born and will one day die. Contact with death or even birth has this effect. Okay. And we shouldn't be too surprised, because if you think about other ancient societies, death, birth, sexual reproduction, rites of puberty, all of those are highly religious events. So it's not surprising that this is a mark, one of the marks of a religious passage. What's interesting about it is that first, it even shows up in the Torah, and second, that God specifically requires certain kinds of practices, behaviors, in order for the person to be fully engaged or fully welcomed back into the community, right? So we find that odd today because of our medical practices, but it wouldn't be odd in an ancient culture at all. All right. Let's go over to 184. This is in the third paragraph. The Torah makes an implicit comment on this in its account of the name given to the first human child. Eve called him Cain, from the Hebrew meaning ownership, saying, I have acquired a child through God. Genesis 4:1. Of course, I put in the margin, Chava accepts ownership in opposition to male dominance, which Sachs doesn't treat. And that's because Sachs doesn't see this passage, as I see it, the case where Chava is basically seeking revenge against her husband for his lack of forgiveness, right? Sachs doesn't see that. Even in the Genesis book, which I was just reading, he doesn't see that. He has a very different interpretation of what's happening when Adam gives the name Chava to the woman, okay? We can talk about that when we get to the Genesis book, if we get there. But the point here is that the interpretation, I have acquired a child through God, is leads us directly to the book that written by the guy I like so much who wrote the book who wrote the book about the Genesis account where he talks about sin knocking at the door. How can I forget? I'm just too tired today. Okay. Anyway, the point is that acquired in that text, and I've written about this because
Rabbi Foreman.
Yeah, Foreman. Yeah, when Rabbi Foreman wrote about this, he said, wait, the grammar of this text is completely wrong, right? Everything about this Genesis text in 4:1 is wrong. The grammar, the use of the words, everything. And if you want to find out all the details of that, just look up Genesis 4:1 on my website and you'll see all these passages. But what he's basically saying is that Chava is not saying that she acquired. She's saying that she bartered. She made a deal. She negotiated with God to get what? A child? No. The word is not yeled. It's ish. She's substituting the child, Cain, for the husband. And there's a lot of stuff going on in that verse that Sachs doesn't talk about here. Anyway, but it's implied there, and we should be quite aware, well aware of that. Then he says in the next sentence, the narrative of the binding of Isaac is a statement for all time that parents do not own their children. What an interesting comment that is. The parents don't own their children. You think about what's happening in the West and you wonder if anybody actually realizes that. Anyway, he says at the next top of the next page, the binding was intended to establish that children belong to God. Parents are merely their guardians. And then, in the next paragraph, Hannah dedicated her child Samuel to God, as did the wife of Manoah, mother of Samson. A mother brought a burnt offering, as did Abraham, in lieu of the child. By doing so, she acknowledged that she was not the owner of the child, merely its guardian. In bringing the offering, it was as if she said, God, I know I should dedicate this child entirely to your service. Please accept this offering in his place. And now that comment helps us understand two things. First, the absolute difference between Israel and the culture that they found themselves in when they entered the promised land, right? Because the God of the Canaanites was Molech, and child sacrifice was part of the religious practices to ensure prosperity, right? You it wasn't that you dedicated the child to God. It's that you sacrificed the child to God, right? So the first thing that you discover is that incredibly different kind of culture that Israel brings into the promised land. The second thing is it helps us understand why Samuel is given over to the priest, right? Because in modern interpretation of the verse, we would wonder, wait a minute, how can the mother just give up this child to the priest? I mean, what, you know, we empathize with the child and the mother saying, oh, how could God demand such a horrible thing that the child should be given away to the priest? But now we understand that, Samuel's mother is not doing anything out of the ordinary at all. She's merely fulfilling the requirement of being the guardian of the child, not the owner of the child. That God is the owner, and therefore she can commit the Samuel to the priest without having to experience community reprisal or without having to feel guilt. Okay? In the last page of this little section, which is the next one, 186, he's in the middle, the second paragraph. The child will one day sin. If there is none on earth so righteous as to do only good and never sin, says Ecclesiastes. So a mother brings a sin offering in advance to atone, as if it were, for any sin the child may commit while still a child. Right? As if to say, God, you knew humans would sin, and so therefore I'm offering this sacrifice in advance. Right? Now, I have a little marginal note that says, we don't know, we don't have a record of this, but it's interesting. My marginal note is a question mark. Did Maria, the mother of Yeshua, bring a sin offering in lieu of, in this same framework? In other words, we don't have a record of what she did, but if she was part of the Jewish community, she would have brought a sin offering to atone for any sins that the child, Yeshua, would have committed. Which is quite an interesting idea. Yes. Lindy, before I get there, the next sentence. Parents are responsible in Jewish law for the sins of their children. Did you get that? That's incredibly important. Parents are responsible for the sins that their children commit. No different than Moses being responsible for the sins that the community committed. Right? Incredibly important. Okay. So now we'll go.
I want to make a comment about did Miriam bring a sacrifice for Yeshua? Most likely that she did. Up until the late early 1900s, in the siddurs at Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the maksurs, there is a statement I have somewhere in the books I have. Where you bring a double pregnant woman, a mother to be, would bring a double offering. We offer, Yom Kippur is all about sacrifices and what have you, but the mother would bring a double for herself, or triple for herself, and one for whether it be a male or a female child she's carrying. So yes, my guess is yes, she did.
Yeah.
And they talk about it all the way up until they took it out of, I'm sure the Orthodox siddurs still have them, or maksurs, but they took it out. Well, at least they took it out in the ones that I have later.
Yeah. What's interesting about that is, I'm sure that she practiced that because it was a part of the religious community expectations. But what's interesting about it is she offers a sin offering for Yeshua, and yet the scriptures say that he is without sin. So that's a real interesting comment on Mary's understanding of Yeshua's relationship and the calling that he has. In other words, what I'm saying is, even if Mary, you know, what are they saying? She kept all these secrets in her heart. Even if she understood that his calling was to be a special envoy from God, she still practiced the kinds of things that you would expect over any human child. And that should help us understand that her appreciation of his role was not Son of God, but basically a emissary, an ambassador, an agent of the Most High God. Very, very different, right? Way different than what the Catholic Church preaches about the consciousness of Mary. Okay. Pam, you have something you wanted to add? I can see your microphone is still on. Balance of your hand. Okay. All right. So now, anything, any other comments you want to make on this section before we leave it? I think the last italics, parents are responsible in Jewish law for their children's commitment of committing of sins, is really, really critical. Think about how that would change the society if we practiced that today. It might make a huge difference on what's happening with the next generation. Okay, let's go to 189. He talks about Richard Nesbitt's Geography of Thought. If you haven't read that book, you need to, because it's a really interesting analysis of the difference between Eastern and Western thought, not in the ancient world, although it applies to the ancient world, but even in the contemporary world, the difference between Eastern and Western thought. And remember that Semitic cultures are Eastern, not Western, even though they're often viewed as the foundation of Western civilization, and particularly of Christianity. They're not Western in their thinking. Semitic cultures are Eastern in their thinking. So you really need to understand how those differences work. And that's a great book. In fact, I probably have, you know what? I think I probably have the whole citations from that book as well. Let me see if I do. And if I do, I'll send them over to you. Let's see if I got it. Richard Nesbitt. Richard Nesbitt. Nope, I don't. Unless I have it under a different filing. Oh, yeah, I do. I have the full citations from Richard Nesbitt's book, and I will add them to the additional materials. So you don't have to go buy the book. Okay, it'll be up there next week. Yes. What?
I said okay. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a great book, fascinating book. Okay, so look what he says in that paragraph, or in that page now, 189. Let's catch the sentence before. They're both in the same category. Chinese children are more likely to say the cow and the grass because where there are cows, there is grass. This is a striking insight. What we see is not simply determined by what is there. Perception is shaped by the words we use and the concepts available to us at a given time in the civilization of which we are a part. And I put in my margins, paradigm. Right? When I lecture on the ship about this stuff, I always tell people that the most influential element in your worldview is your mother tongue, your native language, because it shapes what you actually see in the world, right? If you don't have a cognitive concept in your mother tongue for a certain kind of event, it will not occur. You won't even see it as an event, right? Or as an object, or as a relationship. It won't even exist because you must have the language that determines what things are actually in the world in order to see them. Okay, so really, really important part of what we're doing is to try to unhook our own perceptions of what's happening in the Torah text from the Western civilization perspective, which is the vocabulary of the West, and try to reinstall an ancient Semitic concept that depends on a different kind of language and therefore sees objects or events in the world completely differently. Right? It, from the perspective of the West, some of the things that the ancient Semitic culture is familiar with don't even exist. Right? And vice versa, of course. Which means that the more familiar you are with what's happening in the Hebrew context, the more you will understand why things happen the way they do in the Torah. Okay, and you see the footnote at the bottom about Richard Nesbitt's book. Okay? So let's go over to page 192. In the 1, 2, 3, 4th paragraph. Nothing could do more to damage the kind of nation God was inviting the Israelites to become through their collective experience in Egypt and in the wilderness, a community built on shared memories, hopes, and expectations, and a sense given by covenant of collective responsibility. Okay? Now, Lindy's already pointed out collective responsibility today when we talk about circumcision, but I want you to pay attention to the rest of this, because what he said here is, in fact, developed in a paradigm, a community built on shared memories, right? Hopes and expectations. So a paradigm is more than just a linguistic tool. It actually forms the arrangement of the world. Therefore, if I don't share the same paradigm as the audience of the Torah, my hopes and dreams and expectations, my behaviors in the world will be radically different. Right? And in fact, the paradigm will actually give me the things that I hope for. And this is particularly important when we try to understand why the Jewish people are so resistant to the idea of a Messiah who's already come and who will return. Fundamental to Christianity, right? It's because the paradigm of Jewish thought does not include, it doesn't even include those factors that Christianity emphasizes in the first and second comings of the Messiah. That concept doesn't exist in a Jewish world because why? The Messiah is tied to a political event. The Messiah is tied to a restoration of Israel. The Messiah is tied to a shift in the world perspective on Israel. The Messiah is tied to a resurgence of Torah obedience. All those things that are part of the paradigm of expectations in the Jewish community don't exist in the West today. So, of course, you have to basically discount them, because none of the things that you expect to have happen when the Messiah arrives have actually shown up, right? It takes a Galilean perspective on the Messiah interpreted by Greek Christianity to develop the idea of two different events that surround the Messiah. That doesn't mean that there isn't a Messiah ben Joseph and a Messiah ben David. But those ideas don't show up until the first century, because prior to that, in the Jewish culture, the commitment to understanding who the Messiah is was tied to all these other events which have yet to occur. Right? And it's not a matter of obtuseness. It's a matter of the paradigm. The paradigm tells me what I should expect, and I don't see anything else except those things. I interpret the data of the world from the perspective of my paradigm. And we all do that, by the way. Okay. So let's go over to the next page, 193. He's talking about gossip, of course, but it has all these other implications. So I've underlined the second to the last sentence in the first full paragraph there. It was as if God were saying, if you sin in private, I will advertise your guilt in public, which is exactly, by the way, what Yeshua commented on. And in the next couple of paragraphs down, in the long run, sins do not go unpunished, especially those that people believe they can commit without anyone finding out. Those who sin in private will eventually be exposed in public. And I put a little note in the margin. And then the next sentence or so, and then I will comment on this. They damage relationships and destroy trust, and without trust, no society can survive. Okay, so there it is. The fundamental thought is that sins in secret, gossip in secret, etc., undermines society. Why? Because it destroys trust. And without trust, as I pointed out in my lectures on the ship, the fundamental requirement of any economic system is trust. If I can't trust you, I can't do business. If I can't do business with you, the relationship doesn't work, the society begins to crumble. Why? Because trust underlies all the relationships that I have with everybody else in the society, right? So what Sachs is pointing out is even the subtle, even the most secret, even the most, the smallest indiscretion in communication and in behavior has the tendency to undermine trust. And when it undermines trust, it ultimately will destroy what's happening in the society. Now, the interesting part about his comment is the word eventually, because eventually is a long time off. And so we're looking at this and saying, well, wait a minute, all this stuff is going on, but nothing's happening. How do all these people get away with this? How come there's no accountability? On and on and on. We see it every day, right? And the key for understanding why Sachs why he's tolerant of all of this is that he believes that eventually God will straighten this out. Well, we're all waiting for the messianic age when that will occur. But until then, all this stuff is in process and, frankly, getting worse. I mean, this has happened again and again in the collapse of civilization, but certainly it has now reached a global threshold of a malicious comment, violence, et cetera, that are undermining the society. And, you know, Sachs is quite aware that when those things happen, the society begins to collapse. And eventually, God will restore his own plan. But we're going to have, apparently, a long wait. We've been waiting a long time already. Okay? So, the whole point is that when it comes to a malicious comment, it undermines the society entirely, not just the relationship with the individual. It's not just defamation of character. It's a destruction of the societal bonds that hold people together. Okay. Comments on that section before we go to the next one? We're going to try to do the next one, a couple of pages in the next one, so we'll try that. Roy.
I guess this is the issue with the whole thing on the internet nowadays, because you can say what you want, you can gossip what you want, the line is what you want, and it's gone, and you can't get it back. It's everywhere.
Yep, yep. Douglas Murray, I'm sure you're familiar with, Roy, had an interesting comment about the internet. He says, we've reached a point where the God of the internet never forgives. And he's right, because whatever's out there is out there permanently. It can never be erased, never taken away. No matter how many apologies you issue, it's always there, right? The God of the internet never removes the sins of anyone. And, of course, that's one of the reasons why social media is so dangerous, because it collapses relationships across the board. Okay. Let's try this next little section, which is only a couple of pages. And I just have some comments on 197. Okay, he's talking about the theme of the Haftarah in the Parsha taken from the second book of Kings, a fascinating story about two utterly different individuals. And he says, on 197, the third paragraph, No less significant is the way it shows how a Gentile can become convinced of the truth of Israel's God. There is no suggestion, either on Nahum's part or Elisha's, that this should be, that this should lead to some form of conversion, leaving Syria, perhaps, to live in Israel, or adopting any of Israel's customs. It is enough that he now knows that there is one true God. Right? Interesting. Right? In other words, we started off this session today by talking about the lack of proselytizing and evangelism. But look what he's saying here in this story. It's sufficient for this man, Naaman, to know that there's one true God. That's it. Right? The central values of the Tanakh are strongly in evidence in this story. Healing comes not through any magical performance, but through a simple act of obedience. And basically that's the only, I have one more comment on this section, the last paragraph on page 198. Simple obedience to the word of the Lord without fuss or fanfare, equivocation or excuse, that is the value that drives people, that drives the prophets. Cutting through the often cruel and Machiavellian politics of the ancient world. Okay? So this is interesting because think about this. We think of the prophet today as someone who preaches the good news. That's the way Christians understand it. But look what the prophet in ancient Israel did. All he did was welcome a stranger into the knowledge of the one true God. That's all he did had to do. He didn't go out to recruit or proselytize or evangelize at all. All he had to do was open his arms to say, come in and see the one true God in operation. Right? Come in. Understand what you have to do and do it. That's it. And go back to Syria. It's fine. You don't have to stay here. Right? Okay, so he cuts through, and we have plenty of Machiavellian politics, religious politics going on today, which demand conversion from one form to another, right? Either to Christianity or to Judaism. But notice that it's not part of the prophet's game. The prophet's game is to call the society as a whole back to the Torah, and to open arms to any of those who would approach, not for the purpose of conversion, but just so that they understand who the one true God really is. Interesting. Okay. Okay, I think we better stop here, because the next one, we have a longer section on the power of speech. Okay. Any comments and questions on today's thing? And then I'll send out a message through Mark for what we're going to do next, since this is the last session today.
Well, I'm just wondering what it means for us. Like, we can see society breaking down.
Yes.
And where is the stand that we have to take? I mean, a lot of the sages and the whatever, all of them, not all of them, but they blamed Noah for not speaking or trying to pray for his generation when the flood came. They say he just did what God said to do, and they sort of blame him, right? And when I look at Noah's generation and what we read this morning, the corruption and all of that, I mean, it's our generation. So
yes,
what are we supposed to do? What are we, you know, and most of us are, believe, you know, ex-Christians or whatever. I mean, they're so far out, they don't even know their theology. We were at a funeral yesterday, and man alive, they sing songs that are so backwards in theology that it's like, you can't get over it.
Yes.
So what are we supposed to do? What are we supposed to do?
Yes, okay, good. That's a good question, because it's exactly the same question that we started off with, which is, okay, so if Israel as a whole has not fulfilled what God required of it as in its destiny, therefore its destiny is in jeopardy. Well, not in jeopardy in terms of the covenant relationship, but in jeopardy of failing, right? And then Lindy rightly pointed out that there are exceptions to this. Chabad, which is welcoming, and we know people like Ari and Rabbi Foreman who are open to all of this, right? We should ask ourselves the same thing. What are we doing to reach out? Not to reach out. That's the wrong term. What are we doing to offer ourselves as a welcome a welcome mat for any who are seeking, right? Because you don't drive the seeking behavior of somebody else. That's God's deal. As Yeshua said, God drags them to me, right? So I'm not responsible for a person's motivation to seek God, but I am responsible for being the welcome mat if they should approach me and ask anything that would lead me to share the one true God. Okay? So I think that what we can do is make sure that however we behave or whatever we say is never taken as a roadblock to engagement, right? And that's easy to do, by the way. It's easy to let people think just by action or even by the batting of an eye that their questions are irrelevant or that they don't understand or for whatever reasons they don't belong. So what we're really, I think, called to do is to allow people to belong more than anything else, to allow them to have is for us to have the attractiveness that people feel don't feel threatened to approach, right? One of the things that I say in one of the lectures that I give on the ship at the end of the Roman Empire issue stuff, what I say is that fear is the greatest roadblock to a society being cohesive and surviving. That if I fear the other person, either because I feel I'll be rejected or I'll be excoriated or whatever, if there's some roadblock between me and the other person, then that's already the beginning of the end, right? Because I won't have the ability to share who I am for fear that I will be that reprisals will come my way or I'll be rejected or whatever. So I have to overcome that. I have to be the kind of person who never rejects anyone who genuinely wants to dialogue. And that's difficult to do because there's a whole lot of people that I find their conversation either abrasive or ignorant, right? So I have to restrain myself to make sure that I'm listening more than speaking and that people feel that they can approach me and that they shouldn't feel like I will not want to converse with them. But I think other than that, you know, God puts you in the circumstances where if you say to him, Lord, let me be the one who has the opportunity to welcome someone and make them feel as though they have an avenue for understanding who God is, then I think God will make that happen. As simple a thing as, you know, as a flat tire. I mean, it's an opportunity to engage. I think we have to be really, really aware.
I guess what I find difficult is there's a real push, and I'm glad what Lindy talked about, the hostages coming to God, the Father, the Creator. But there's a real push now in Western society to push the Christian evangelical
message. Oh, yeah. I think Charlie Nation had a lot to do with that. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's, for me, that's like we're being pushed there. We're pushing a generation in another path that's not really the godly path.
Yes, but think about it this way. You're pushing a generation from idolatry to awareness of spirituality. That's how I look at it. You know, do I think that that Erica Kirk is giving her audience the right understanding of God when she basically talks about evangelical Christianity? No, I don't think that's right at all. But there are people who are finally listening that weren't listening at all. And maybe God uses that to awaken morality, a spirituality that will lead them, like it's led all of us, to discover, to dig deeper. Right? That's the best that I can hope for. somebody's going to knock on my door and say, how come you live like you do, or how come you say these things? I mean, it happens on the ship all the time. I mean, I never talk about religious stuff except as it results to history and culture. And inevitably, I have somebody on the ship come up and say, you know, you said some things that make me wonder. First they say, are you Jewish? And I say, no. And then they say, well, yeah, but what about these things that you said about, you know, this and this and this, and I hinted at things. And that opens the door for conversation. But it's entirely up to them. It isn't me telling them that you have to believe this. It's me pointing out the collapse of the society, which they already appreciate, and providing maybe some understanding of how the answer should go. And then it's up, you know, and then I find people saying, "What can I talk to you about this?"
Right. Yeah, I got the feeling yesterday again, because we saw people at the funeral we hadn't seen in 30 years that are pastors or whatever. And the theological paradigm is so strong. Yes. I mean, they ask us, do you go to a church? And then we start, well, no, because the number study, you know, we go through the 10 years and we're 15 that we've been on this journey. And it's like,
yeah. And
not make any sense of it. The theological paradigm is too thick, and it just prevents them. And it's so discouraging. It's like, oh my goodness, you know, like, you taught, you were in the church, you know, we have this, talk my kid, you know.
At least you understand that that's exactly what we talked about when we talked about paradigm today, right?
Yeah.
The hope, the expectations, the interpretation of the event, the facts themselves are determined by the paradigm. So if I saturate myself in the Christian Orthodox paradigm long enough, I will see everything in the world according to that paradigm. And there's nothing I can do to break through that paradigm at all until God does something like return me from you know, being kidnapped for almost 2 years. Then a breakthrough happens. Then something happens, and I have to rethink, right? And unfortunately, most Christians are comfortable. As the guy in South Africa told me every time that we brought this up, he said, well, I'm comfortable with what I believe. And he's absolutely right. As long as he's comfortable with what he believes, no change will occur. He has to come to the point like Naaman when he's got, you know, this illness that he can't cure, that the crisis is what causes a shift in the paradigm. As long as they're comfortable, that's exactly what they're going to stay with.
Hello, Skip. This is Larry.
Yeah.
How do you think when Matthew says, as you go into the nations, making disciples, how do you think that ties into this, if at all?
Okay, so, but he doesn't, we've been through this before, and the whole point is...
Could I come in here, Skip?
I'm sorry?
Could I come in on this, on what Larry said, because I was just waiting to share that.
Yeah.
No, the paraphrase of that, the paraphrase of that verse is, as you walk through life, you'll meet people, and your impression of how you are, how you're acting, where you're going in your life is going to touch them. And that opens the door, just like you said, on the ship. People come to you because of the way that you are, the walk that you have. I don't think it's an imperative. I think it's because you are, this is going to happen.
Yeah. That's exactly right, because the actual grammar of the verse is a participle, as you are going, right? It's, so it's not a command. I mean, Protestant Christianity has made it into an imperative, right? You need to do this. You need to go out and recruit people. But that's not what he says. What he says is, as you're going along, right? And notice he doesn't say, as you're going along, make disciples, right?
No.
He says, as you're going along, and the next verb is important. Because it's not about making disciples. It's about having the opportunity to interact with people so that they become a disciple, right? My job is not to make disciples. It's to disciple. It's to be the welcoming mat that allows people to get in touch with my life and consequently want to mimic what I already have. And ultimately then baptize, which is the symbol that I've adopted this new paradigm.
Yeah, and I would agree with all that. It just seems to be exactly what we're talking about. That's what happens in our lives. We meet people, and we share some things we're doing, and they start asking questions. We don't necessarily have to push ourselves. But, and I understand about the misinterpretation. As a matter of fact, the end of that verse where it talks about baptizing in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit isn't even in the oldest text,
yeah,
the oldest written text, right? So it was added later, if you will. Thank you.
Yeah, but the whole point is to answer that, to use that verse in answer to Lisa's question. It's not up to me to bring people into the kingdom. God will drag them in. It's up to me to make sure that I'm available when they do show up. Right?
And Skip, it's up to us to be keeping the commandments so that we're attracting them to the right thing.
Yes.
You know, one of the things that really settled me down, especially with my children, because I was a really active Christian, was that I realized that I was operating out of fear all the time. I feared that their blood would be on my hands. I feared that they were going to go to hell. I feared that that's what drove my evangelism. And as I look around the people that are out, you know, on the street corners thumping Bibles, it's out of fear. It's not out of, I mean, they love those people, but they're afraid. It's not a come in where this is so attractive. This is where you need to be. Don't you want this for yourself? You know, it's not about being afraid of something. It's about being attracted to it. So that changed my whole perspective on this entire thing. We're supposed to be a community of attraction that looks so lovely that people can say, how could I not want that?
Yes, good point. Lindy, you want to add something?
I was just going to add to Pam, it seems to be out of the Bible thumpers and the people that stand with the signs and the whole guy. It seems to be out of competition as well. You have to compete. How many people did you pass a week to win? You know, it's competition. Like it's not good enough. It's not good enough. It's not good enough. You know, it's. I mean,
I think that there is
New York because they are all in the subways.
Yeah, I think that there's that element as well. But when what Pam is saying, I would echo in the development of Christian theology, because if you go to just about any of the major churches in Israel, all Catholic, of course, there's always a Last Judgment painting, right? And what's the painting of the Last Judgment? You are going to be punished eternally. You're going to have all these terrible things happen to you if you don't convert. So it's a fear-based conversion. It's all about, I'm going to try to escape from all the stuff that, you know, God's going to do to me. And of course, that leads to, the evangelical idea that you have to be saved from hell in order to make sure that you're going to eternally be blessed. And none of that is attractive at all. So, okay. So are we done? Everybody's had a chance to say something today? If you want to? Okay.